Television is history, yeah.
This is the Matador Revisionist History Podcast, and today we are talking to Pretty Girls Make Graves on the 20th anniversary of their huge breakthrough record, The New Romance. I talked to Andrea and Jay from the band, along with Phil Eck, legendary producer, who produced the record in 2002. Matador is bringing back The New Romance on white vinyl this November, and there's also two unreleased songs from those sessions that are streaming for the first time now. Check them out. They are sick. This was so much fun, and I would say that anybody who is thinking about doing a band, thinking about going for it, this is a very inspiring chat. I mean, there seems to be nothing but love and respect between these band members still, and they had a great experience with The New Romance. So let's check in and find out about what went down, how it happened, and how they're doing.
Matador, revisionist history, yeah.
Which I guess is a good way to kind of get into, you guys got involved with Matador Records, because you all are so Seattle, and Matador is, I still always think of as a New York concern. So how did this all go down?
I don't think I 100% remember. I think we were just approached by Lombardi, I think, right, Andrea?
I think that Lombardi reached out, like, maybe on a band email.
Yeah.
Yeah, like cold call. Out of nowhere.
Really?
And we were like, what?
Side note of that for me was, I was really excited because your band was one of my favorite bands.
Oh, shit.
So dude, I was thanks. Like, I love Matador because I love Chavez. Wow. So I was really stoked. I may have been the most stoked, maybe. Not to say that no one else was stoked, but I may have been like the most stoked because of that.
Well, like, what's interesting is, again, Seattle is... The Pacific Northwest is its own region, ecosystem, musical culture, and stuff like that. I thought it was cool that Matador was involved with you guys. I wonder what was that? I guess it was surprising that this label just out of the blue called you from New York.
Oh yeah, really surprising. I mean, we were all floored by this, I don't know if this is true. I feel like I kind of have a memory, like maybe Chris read the Good Health review in Pitchfork and was like, huh, who's this band? Or I feel like him mentioning something like that once, being like that catching his eye.
I
don't know if that's correct, but
there's something he mentioned something. Okay. I could tell you that I remember going to see Blood Brothers with him along, you know, way back when they were around, and I feel like maybe that's what put his eye maybe on the scene or something like that. He mentioned something about Blood Brothers when I asked him about what the background was, but I think it could have been, maybe it was that, I don't know, but again, it's funny because it really was like they picked you guys because they liked the music, you know, and there wasn't any,
yeah.
there was no.
And we were floored. We were
Yeah.
I always forget about Nils, though. Nils was the other connection to Seattle, too.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And that's right, because Nils, in fact, I found out about Modest Mouse from Nils. Mm-hmm. And Phil, do you go back with Nils?
Yeah, I knew Nils when I was in high school. I used to not get my Sub Pop Singles Club of the Month singles, and I don't know if they were stolen or they just never got delivered to my house. My buddy down the street, did you get the Fugazi 7-inch? I'm like, no. So I call up Sub Pop, and that's how I met Megan Jasper, being this 17-year-old kid who never got his damn singles. So I go there and skip school, and I go take the ferry over to Seattle, and I grew up in Bremerton, close where Andrea is right now. I would go there and they'd send me down on the third floor, and there'd be Nils Bernstein like, here you go, give me my singles. So that's how I met him back, in early days of Sub Pop.
I would say that he's, in my mind, one of the most important figures in music who that so gracefully stays under the radar. Yeah.
For me, he was, he had a really, really great record store in Seattle that was really important. Rebellious Jukebox was a really important record label or a record store for me. That I bought and sold stuff from him when I was just a kid, and we remained friends ever since. And actually his brother Bjorn works in my house.
That's so, dude, I just saw, you might know Maurice Menares, I was running in the park this morning and he saw me and he said, I was all sweaty and he said, I'm scarred for life looking at you this morning. Which is a very Per Bernstein level joke. Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Jay, your guitar playing is so fucking sick.
That's crazy, but thank you.
I guess we'll get to that later. So when Matador approaches you guys, you guys were in full swing as a band and very busy when they hit you?
Yeah, we were like, we were really lucky. I mean, we were all coming from other bands, so we were like instantly kind of busy as a band and kind of, I think it was our second show was opening for Fugazi, right? Is that right, Andrea?
I think that was our first show.
Yeah. So
I think it was, wow. Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But first we were just show. Like, we had that, you know, that mentality of just like play shows and tour and stuff right out of the gate. So we were definitely just going for it.
When the band got together, you're all coming from different bands, and I noticed that the songwriting seemed like you wrote everything together, like in a room. Is that how it would work, or how did Pretty Girls Make Grave as a musical force come together?
Yeah, we wrote the songs like all together. I think the first EP, I think there were three or four of the songs that were written before I was in the band, because they had started like a few months. I think it was a few months before I joined. I can't remember, but so I think there were like three songs that were either fully written or partially written. But after that, it was lots and lots of hours of in a room together hashing it out, for sure.
And Andrea, how was that process?
It was good. We all didn't know each other very well. Derek and I had played together in three bands before this. But I did not know Nick. I knew his brother, Callie, better than I knew Pat. I don't even remember if I'd even met Pat at that point. It's hard to place. I'd probably met him. But it was writing with people I didn't know in the very beginning. So that was totally different and kind of like, how do we do this? And what's your style? And what's your style? And figuring that out. And that was, you know, it was interesting.
Was it nerve wracking? Or was there like a confidence level, like we're going to fucking do this and it's cool?
I think that there was a confidence level where we're like, we just want to fucking play music. Let's just play music.
Right.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. It's funny to think back about it being a confidence level where I'm like, was it? I don't know.
It was. Just, I think everyone was
going to fucking do this.
A little cocky at the time, a little bit. Not in a bad way, but like everyone was just like, you know, I mean, Derek was in Emergency Devils and that was a successful band. We were all like, you know, in our prime in a way.
Right.
We were young. Right. So we thought we were in our prime.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you guys were kids, so you were just going for it.
Yeah, exactly.
But also, y'all had band experience already, so there's also that kind of confidence.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah. That was the same deal as Chavez. We had kind of done our first bands or whatever, and then felt like we were okay. But still, it's funny. I just had a situation where I was playing music with old friends, but we had never played together, and everybody admitted afterwards, and it went great, but everybody admitted afterwards, it was like, oh, I was kind of fucking nervous, you know? like, even though, like, you know each other, you're just that thing. But you guys play together as a band so well, so I guess...
I will say, I remember the first EP, I don't think I heard any of most of the vocals before Andrea recorded them. And, like, because I don't think we had a good setup, or I don't remember how we wrote it, but I remember walking to the Cha-Cha in Seattle and, like, hearing music and being like, I'm familiar with this song, but I was like, but who's screaming? Because I had never heard the song with the final vocals. And then they were like, oh, this is what Andrew did today. And I was like, oh, shit. Oh, wow.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's
funny to learn.
It's also the way how deftly your vocals fit in with these really, really cool and, you know, original structures. I found myself when I was re-listening to it the other day and getting ready for this, just being like, "How the hell does, like, how did that work? How did that work?" As far as you'd sit there, there these incredible you know, non-traditional chords, structures and melodies and stuff, and then your job is to find the Northwest Passage to, and you really did it, you do it so well, of kind of tying the thing together. Does that make sense?
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I guess thinking about it like that, I can look back and be like, yeah, that was a totally different way to think about singing in that context. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it was, I guess I think it probably was more challenging than I remember, but I think it's cool how everything came together.
I gotta I definitely give you credit, because we didn't even talk music, like notes. We didn't say words like that at all.
Right.
And so it was just kind of like, it's either going to work or it's not, is kind of how we approached it, which is fine. It worked. But for you, that means you had to navigate like weird, you know, like sometimes out of key guitar parts or things, and find a place to fit in, which had to have been really hard, you know, in retrospect.
Yeah. And also, and because Jay, your style is so, is like arpeggiated, you know what I mean? So there's already this, there's all these melodies that are happening, you know, it's not just like a block of chords that you sing over and stuff.
And
there's a lot of choices.
It's really
Andrew.
Cool.
What's that?
Yeah.
You had a lot of notes to choose from with what those guys were playing, and to find a commonality and kind of a pop commonality, like this is a strong chorus and this is a strong melodic verse or bridge or whatever, is kind of hard with what Nathan and Jay were playing sometimes, because it was at times pretty chaotic, which was what made it so cool and it made it very interesting and sometimes challenging. But to be able to, I'm just going to sing this melody over the top of, you know, whatever the hell was going on in any given song, was a lot. Yeah. I mean, we had that sometimes, those conversations in the studio when we were doing that new romance, where we had to talk about like, this is what the melody's going to be on somebody's side. Sometimes we had to change guitar parts for that. You know, Nathan had to change his part, or Jay had to change his part, just because it was too out there and we didn't have somebody just play a chord or whatever.
Right. I think thinking about it now, I can remember that I was working a lot back then. And so I think everyone else was able to get together without me to work on songs more often than I was. We were all together. So often it would be the same thing where I'd show up and be like, oh shit, this is you know, like now there's a lot of layers on this, not recording, but writing back then.
Right. Jay, how the hell did you come up with playing like that? It's really cool. I mean, like, it's not easy for me to pinpoint, oh, he's doing this, he's listening to that.
Well, I would say definitely Drive Like Jehu.
Awesome.
And I was a big Rocket from the Crypt fan, which is tied into that. This dude, have you ever heard of the band Ink and Dagger? It's like a hardcore band from Philly. Don DeVore, his guitar playing, like later on, was really influential on me. And I mean, if you listen to all those things, you'll see it all kind of fall. And Fugazi, of course, actually.
And so that kind of cascadey, stringy thing, is that what kind of got you stoked about making up guitar lines and stuff?
I was obsessed with Drive Like Jehu because I didn't understand, like, out of all the music I listened to, like punk rock or indie rock or something, I didn't understand how they got their guitar tones. I'm sure Phil and I probably talked about this when we were recording stuff, because it was like so clean but slightly distorted, and like it's funny because I was listening or going through some videos and just listening to some stuff for this, and I was thinking about that, and I was like, I kind of had a weird guitar tone because it was like kind of clean.
Totally, it stands out. It's way clean, but there's a little growl.
Yeah, exactly.
It's unusual, and also sounds really good now to me. You know, like it's like, oh, this is, it sounds fresh. And like I played in a band called Wider, who formed in order to put on a show for Drive Like Jehu in New York City. And this was back when Rocket from the Crypt was the weird band, and Jehu was like, remember that? like that was the vibe, you know? It's like, if I do this other band, Rocket from the Crypt, you know? Like, okay, that's funny. I actually had Jehu question mark down in my notes as far as the thing they made.
Yeah, just John Reese in general was a big influence on my guitar playing, for sure.
Sick. My friend just bought a PV amp from John Reese.
Oh, cool.
Yes. and he swears by it. Apparently, John Reese has the sick studio in his house that's like all tiki'd out.
Yeah, Dave Gardner, who is around here sometimes, he records or masters for John all the time. So he was helping him put together that room, I think, not too long ago. John was up at our studio last year, I think, which was cool. So I had to keep it cool because that was the first time. I met him when I was like, I think like 16 or something. And then he came to our studio and I was like, oh, don't look at my arm because there's a tattoo there. But
sick. Oh, he's such a god. He's awesome. Nah, so then Phil, how did you come to these guys?
Oh, I think being friends in Seattle. I think I knew Derek first and then met you all after. I didn't know any. I don't think even Andrea, I don't think we had met. Really? Before
stuff.
I'm really good friends with Dan Gallucci, who was the guitar player of Mercy Devils. And so he was him and Spencer, my connection to Derek originally. So that's how I met Derek. And, you know, we were friends and see him around town. And, you know, I was just a guy in Seattle making records. And yeah, we met at, first time I saw him play was at the Showbox. And I don't know who in the world you're playing with or if it was your show, but that's when we did the, like we talked about doing the Sub Pop single.
Oh yeah.
And it started there, and then we did the Good Health EP, and then it just kept going from there to the New Romance over a period of however many years that would have been, 2 years, 2.5 years or something like that. But just, you know, it's especially back in the early late 90s, early 2000s, it was a small town and still is now, but everybody, if you're in music, pretty much knew everybody some way. So that's kind of how we all kind of met each other, and then ended up doing a really fast Sub Pop single that was super fun, and it was just like play and go kind of style, and it came out cool, and we liked each other, and we got along, and then we just had more time and more, you know, I don't know, grew as musicians, and I tried to always grow as a producer and engineer, and I think we had more time every time we did something in the studio, to the point where we got to the New Romance, we had a good amount of time, if I remember. I feel like we worked like a month on it.
We had at least a month.
Yeah. At least, right? Dude, but we, and I also feel like that's, was this 2002, like winter of 2002 when we recorded this? Do you remember?
I don't.
Because it came out in 2003.
That sounds right.
So we must have recorded it. I remember it being kind of cold out at Bear Creek and being kind of cloudy and rainy and stuff like that. But yeah, we were there. And also, I don't think we took any days off, did we? Just went every single day, which is nuts. But I'm pretty sure we went every single day.
We did. I was just surprised that we didn't stay there because there was rooms there. But we drove out every single day.
It would have been more expensive. It would have been more expensive.
No, that's true. That's right.
And we drove every single day. And I got that car wreck. Remember?
Oh, that's right.
I forgot about that.
I do remember.
Yeah. I-5. I trashed my car.
On the way to work.
Do you remember that? Yeah. Leaving the studio, Jay, you were behind me. Remember?
Yeah.
You're like, what the hell is a car wreck? Holy shit, that's Phil.
Oh shit.
Yeah, totally destroyed my car, but drove home and everybody was fine. But yeah, that was just like it. That's the only thing it really did suck about going to Bear Creek is it's just like 45 minutes there and back every day. It was just like, but yeah, I mean, it was I listened to that record and going back to guitar tones. There's a lot of stuff with you and Nathan that was, you know, wild, and some of it just like when it really sinks in, it's just like, oh, it just scratches that itch. But I was thinking the exact same thing about the production of the guitars, is that the whole record is super big and clean, but aggressive at the same time. And that's really pretty hard to do. Like, I think now I would have more of a issue doing it than I somehow did then. But all the sounds are so cool on that record. Like, the guitars are rad, the bass is cool and distorted, then there's chorus on the bass, and there's background vocals that are cool and weird distorted vocals and really clean loud vocals, and I don't know, drums are all over the place and they're rad sounding. I remember just changing the sounds of the drums a bunch on each record or each song. But that was my biggest goal, to make it feel like your guys' live energy and have this energy of it, like kind of unhingedness, but then drops in these big choruses and stuff that felt really good. But just to feel really, really clean and big the whole time was probably the biggest challenge. But it just sounded really cool to me when I listened to it, like just a couple of days ago, having not listened to it in a long time. I think we all.
I remember you. What I learned from you, Phil, during that with the guitar stuff is that's when I learned to use smaller amps when recording. Because I was always a half stack guy, just half stack. And we were like using Champs and Princetons and stuff. And that's how we got a lot of those cool guitar sounds.
Yeah. I mean, we would use your amp. Like, I remember you coming in because we were tracking in the control room, and I remember you had to kind of walk sometimes through the live room to get to the bathroom or something like that, and you come in, you're like, those amps are fucking loud. Like they're cranked. But that's how we got those sounds, is not having preamp loud, but having preamp, you know, whatever, 3 or 4 and master 10, like all the way up. So it's like, you're not just getting preamp distortion. You're getting all this overdrive from the speakers, and honestly, kind of the vibration of the damn cabinets or whatever we were using, kind of almost rattling, was had a lot to do with the weird kind of almost buzzy tones that would happen sometimes. You know, we worked a lot on that record. I also forgot that all the keyboard stuff, it's all Reason, isn't it?
Yeah, it was all Reason.
None of it's real, is it?
None of it's real.
But it all sounds. But the funny thing is that this is 2002, you know, digital technology, not the coolest thing in the world at this point, but they all sound rad. They all sound really cool. Like all the Farfisa kind of sounds and stuff.
I forgot about that too. And when I was listening to it, I was like, I had to remember. I was like, oh, this is all Reason. I don't even know if I could get as cool of a sound, because I think I made a preset of just a bunch of crap.
Yeah, you made your own, built your own stuff. Yeah, it's back when you would flip the back and look at the, you know, like dangling quarter inch cords on the back of your modules and shit.
Yeah.
But we did, and this, if I'm also, I know we did some Pro Tools syncing for sounds and some kind of delays and stuff, like maybe some drum machine stuff. But this is all pretty much still tape, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Didn't we do the whole record on tape with just some syncing of Pro Tools?
Yeah. And then mixed it down to half inch.
Yeah, we mixed it down to half inch tape, yeah. But that in itself, I thought, was cool, because it was also the height of maybe really good analog tape and maybe the kind of beginning of better sounding digital stuff. But I was not a big promoter of digital, because I thought digital recording, at least like Pro Tools, sounded terrible. So Andrea, we had to punch all your vocals over and over again. We couldn't do any, there's no comping. There's no comping at all.
No comping.
It's like performances punched.
Yep.
Which is pretty amazing.
But that benefits, again, it's the tech sounds sound really fucking cool, and you can't place them. You know, you can't be like, oh, they're doing that, they're doing this. It's like really unique sounds. And then also the vocal has this performance where it feels like from top to bottom, there's a sense of a human being singing, as opposed to a super chopped digital comp.
Yeah, I mean, especially back in those days when you just, for me at least as a producer, when you can't, easily, when you're on tape, you can't easily comp. I was a taskmaster. people performed a lot and over again.
Oh, okay.
Mostly to their chagrin, but it's the only way I knew how to do what I thought ultimately the song needed in the end. And they're spot on. They're so cleanly doubled and so strong all the time. And Andrew was probably like, fuck, I don't want to do this again. Phil's just going to make me do this a million damn times.
Yeah, but, how was that, Andrea? I want to know about that.
But I think those things are, at the end of the day, that's what you hear, and it sounds like it wasn't labored over, and it should sound like it wasn't labored over. So I think that's pretty cool about that record.
I will.
Absolutely.
Agreed.
I have to give you...
But Andrea, I want to know.
I have to give you credit, Phil, quick. Because if it weren't for you being a taskmaster, I probably wouldn't even be doing what I'm doing. I learned a lot from I remember we were tracking guitar once, and I can't remember what song it was, and you just looked at me and you were like, so how about a little less Guitar Hero? And I was like, because I was just always bending the neck like I was playing live or something. Like I was feeling it a little too much, but it's like, you can't.
Yeah, it's a record stuff. Yeah,
exactly. So...
Yeah, I think that. No, I appreciate it, guys, because when you're making records, especially when at my age at that time, you know, I think I wasn't. It was, you just are going so quickly. You don't always have the time to say you're saying, like I would say now, why I was doing that. Sure. I just like, you just got to do it. I don't have a time to explain, or maybe I didn't feel I had the time to explain. So you know, I know there could be times going, oh, this is so hard, but you know, I think that's why we kept working together too, though, is that the results were cool and the vibe was always cool. And I was also surprised at some of the effects we used on. There's a lot of the cool distortions and filters, and I forgot about the drum delays and stuff we did. And it's cool.
Yeah.
There's like weird stuff that we did.
That thing.
I just honestly forgot about a lot more textures and outros that had pianos, acoustic guitar. Like we recorded acoustic guitar on that song. Like we did. Yeah, we did. I don't remember doing that at all.
It was super cool, Phil. Yeah. And for the record, I learned so much from you also, but I also remember us having a blast. Like, no, I remember us joking all the time, like almost maybe too much, like back and forth. Like, probably it was hard sometimes to like get out.
And then now sing. And good stuff. It is true. It was quite a fun. It was just fun. The whole thing was ridiculous and fun, and we worked super hard and long hours and whatever. But yeah, it was listening back and thinking about how you make records. I make records now and stuff like that. It's sort of like, I felt proud of all of us for going through all that time together and having a blast and, you know, driving all the way out there and being exhausted and pulling these whole 12-hour days over and over again for a month and then mixing the damn thing. Actually, that's the only time I've ever worked at Bear Creek where I did the entire record start to finish, including mixing in that studio. It's the only record I've ever did there that way.
Yeah, wow.
I did songs and stuff.
That's cool.
Did you all have this? How together were the songs when you showed up at Bear Creek?
I remember them being pretty close to what they were. I mean, for the most part. Because you guys were practicing. You were practicing in the egg room, weren't you, this time?
Yeah, I was just going to say, Phil, you're right about remembering the season, because thinking of the egg room, which Matt, this is where we were practicing at the time. Our practice space was above in an apartment above a club that we played at a lot. Some maniac who had lived in this apartment had built this tire and like huge papier-mâché art installation. And left it, and it was super weird. And one of the things they built was this giant papier-mâché igloo, this white igloo. And that's where we practiced. In this igloo that was like freezing, and we called it the egg room. And these parties are after shows to pay the rent on the practice space. I think Jay probably did a lot more.
Yeah, I was there. Sure.
Bartending.
Surely did.
Yeah.
I feel like I may have gone every show. I may have been in that place because I have this memory of going to a place that sounds like that. That was above. It was a weird room, and it was a party after a show.
Was this Graceland? Yeah.
Seattle. I was wasted, but I had a really good fucking time.
You went there, man. Really. You definitely went there.
And coming back, it definitely had to do with you guys for sure. Yeah. Like that space. Amazing.
Whoa. It was really a crazy environment. It was freezing. That's where I just really remember being cold in that room. So you're right about it being winter, I think, before we were recording, Phil.
But because I remember coming to practices with you guys just to hear what was going on and being a little confused as to what was going on because it was just so bombastic in there and didn't sound good. And I could barely hear you. I think there's a lot of times I'm not even sure sometimes you sang or maybe you weren't even there. I feel like I went a couple times with you guys and this, we talked about the songs. We talked about the, you know, this, that, and the other thing. I don't remember getting demos, but maybe I did. But we went in, we changed some stuff, either tempo wise or sometimes guitar part wise, just to fit what made more sense, like Jay's parts better than Nathan's part, or vice versa, just to kind of make it sometimes a little bit more cohesive. But I remember being pretty much good to go. Don't you remember that?
Yeah, I know that I had to do like, I think it was. This is our emergency. I didn't have a guitar part for that because I think Derek and Nathan and Nick wrote that like in one day before I got to practice or like right towards maybe, you know, when we're going to record. So I spent the whole day like in the van trying to come up with a guitar part.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah. I remember that. You had your laptop and you're just playing your guitar.
I kind of feel like maybe we wrote that in the studio. It was not a song. Like Nathan had that guitar line and then maybe they were just like messing around or something, or maybe that happened in the egg room and then they brought it there. But same thing. Cause I wrote all those lyrics. I remember out in the car.
It was just like a loop of a thing. And we kind of had to make it go up and down. Right. It just does one part over and over again, basically.
Yeah.
Right.
I was thinking, Phil, is it still the case that you have like this is almost rhetorical. Just having that cool relationship with a singer where you can go back and forth with them and tell them what to do, and they're not going to freak out because everybody trusts each other, and you want to get it right, and you want to, you know, you want to get the best performance. Because I feel like now so many people record by themselves and there isn't a kind of back and forth dialogue between a trusted listener.
Yeah. I still do. I mean, people do record themselves maybe more than I wish they did, but no, I think, I still think the records I produce and work on these days, I'm still, you know, 90% of the time in the room with them, you know, we're all in the same studio together. And maybe I'm not doing the same amount of punching cause I don't need to, but I would definitely do, you know, many, many, many playlists and with the same idea of like, no, we got to hit that voice or, you know, you have to hit that intensity of that chorus. If we don't get it, we'll punch it. But I still have the coaching aspect of directing, as it were, and kind of guiding the performance that sometimes people, I think the easiest thing is lose intensity. Like they get kind of tired and you have to keep them up there and stuff like that or what have you. So yeah, not as same as I used to, just because I'm not doing as many punching where you're just like, go, 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 go. But I do have that same kind of one-on-one with the singer as much as I can.
So when the record, did you feel like, did you know that you guys did something special? Like, I know that's kind of a dumb question, but it's happened to me a couple of times in my life where I'm like, oh, this is really good. Like this feels like something, this feels like I maybe cracked some sort of personal code or anything, or you know, like did it feel like, did it feel cool when you were done, but before everybody heard it, where you're like, this is it?
It felt really cool to me.
Yeah, it did. It was also the time and place, like in Seattle at that time, just everything felt like it was aligning for us to kind of do what we did. Mm-hmm. For some reason, it just, everything just felt like it lined up where you don't, you know, you see it every once in a while. And I think back to that and it's like, yeah. So the record, when we were done, you know, even out of the other ones, I think it felt the most like, oh, this is kind of a big deal, because instantly we were doing, you know, weird press stuff, just like, but it did feel special. Even the process. Remember how? What about the cover?
I was about to ask.
I'm taking over. I was trying to remember. There's a whole story about the cover, and I can't remember exactly what it was.
There is. I was trying to remember about that recently. Also, that studio, Bear Creek Studio, Matt. I don't know if you're familiar with it for any reason, but it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It is out of the city, in the woods. Huge, old, beautiful barn, horse pasture. Creek with, like, I swear I felt like Sam responding, but that wouldn't make sense for the season probably, but like you could just go out and walk and just be on all this land. But we're like, the horses were with us. We were with the horses every day. Mm. There was also that dog. Yeah. Do you remember that dog,
Ella,
Phil?
Oh, yeah.
chew the rocks and it chewed all its teeth down.
Yeah, no teeth.
Like, oh my God.
Had like nubs of teeth left. It was so sad, but it was like obsessive about like chewing and carrying those huge rocks in its mouth.
Yeah, gnawing on it.
We'd That's like go, something that sticks out.
Yeah, we'd all be, this is back when all of us smoked or whatever. Some of us smoked. Me and Jay definitely did. And we'd be out there in that, outside the control room just going, no, the dogs are gnawing on these damned rocks, and we'd be smoking cigarettes, like cranking the mix, coming out of the, you know, that's freezing cold in the rain.
Oh, I know.
It's so gross. But yeah, anyways, not to interrupt you, but
yeah, no, but no interruption. But I mean, that imagery was very much part of that recording process. It felt really special and magic out there, like being in the city and then coming out to nature like that. And that was like how that influence of that cover started. The drama about the cover, I don't quite remember, but
I think it was inspired by, there was a picture I think that Nathan found, and then we couldn't get the use of it or whatever, so then there's like a reshoot of something. I think that's what happened. I can't 100% remember.
And the horse idea came because you'd been hanging out with horses
in this beautiful like
barn,
picturesque, yeah. Barn is where the studio is. We're hanging out with horses every day.
it always makes me the cover, which is pretty iconic, and I it's funny, when I saw it, I was like, oh my God, that record, I saw that so much. Like, I saw that image so much, like at the time, and I always think of Equus, you know, that play Equus. Mm-hmm. It's like a fucked up play about a kid who has sex with a horse, but it's a. But it's like, but there's something like upsetting about that cover somehow. It's pretty, but it's like sort of.
Well, the horse doesn't necessarily look like it's at rest necessarily. <It's> like,
yeah,
exactly. And it's black, you know. And then there's this black thing, and it seems like something like maybe this horse is in danger or something like that. But like who was helming that imagery?
Well, Kevin Willis took that photo, didn't he? If memory serves.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was, like I said, I think it was, there was another photo that we wanted to use, and we had Kevin do a photo shoot, I think.
that's how I kind of remember it as well.
And that lack of friction that that you guys had as far as things just sort of lining up seems to follow through with how the record was received, and also the way that, I guess, Matador did a good job promoting it. Because it's funny, I was talking to a friend who just so vividly remembers how that record made it out to rural New Jersey. You know what I mean? And that it was like, I think she may have said that Pitchfork may have had to also maybe got behind it, and that was like a new thing or something like that. But just that she was really aware of this band, you know, somehow, and that she may have found out about it from a Matador sampler and stuff. But I kind of wanted to get into how, you know, once the record rolled out and you guys toured, how it hit and what that felt like with bringing it to the people, you know, the reception.
I feel like things happened really fast when that came out. It's kind of hard to remember the details because I feel like things just like started moving.
We did like, I think it was, at least for us and probably for a lot of bands, it was kind of towards the tail end of like that traditional kind of album push, at least for indie bands, because I think they flew us out to New York. We did press and we did like photo shoots. Like it was like instantly we were doing all this stuff that was, like I said before, it was kind of overwhelming because it was such a different world from what we were used to, which is just like hopping in the van, sleeping in the van and playing shows wherever, to kind of, you know, being a part of this machine. And they did do a great job of like, you know, getting the record out there. Like we did a lot of press for that album, and I think we did some pretty cool photo shoots with like some big photographers in retrospect that I didn't even know who they were at the time. But yeah, it was, I mean, they just kind of threw us into the machine, and then we started touring right away, like on it, and I don't think we stopped for like 2 years or something.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously we have the benefit of time, but it seems like it went cool and smooth. I mean, but I don't know. I mean, I'm on the outside and I'm not asking for any kind of shit talking, but like, even when I asked Chris, you know, I just said, was there any drama? This seems like it went, I was like, how did you meet up with him? He's like, I can't really remember. He said something about the Blood Brothers, but he's like, yeah, went out, met them, thought they were great, loved hanging out with them, just felt really good, and it was easy. Which I never fucking hear that shit, you know, about a band story or an album cycle or anything. There's always some drama, but, and I'm not looking for it, but it seems like it went good.
At least for that album cycle, it was pretty smooth. I mean, we did lose Nathan as a guitar player at one point, but that, you know, because he got his girlfriend or wife pregnant, like you said, not to talk shit, but we toured with bands that none of us like necessarily, but you know, it was like we wanted to play for more people. We wanted to, you know, just play music.
I feel like we hit it off with Lombardi right away, and it was easy. It was really fun to hang out with him and everyone who was at Matador. I don't know. It did feel easy. Like everyone there was so cool, and it didn't seem hard to interact with them in any way. I just wanted to add that.
Matador instantly felt like a family.
Yeah.
Like it seemed, you know, we go to the office that was in Soho and just hang out all day with everyone. And, you know, it was very chill, and then go do karaoke and all the stuff they love to do. But
you know,
yeah, that was, it was really easy to get along with him as a label. And we didn't butt heads about even direction of like what we wanted to achieve. It was so easy.
Yeah. I want to touch something quickly just that you said, and this is just out of curiosity and maybe, and for listeners, you said that you toured with bands that maybe you weren't so into or whatever, that you wouldn't ever imagine playing with in order to reach people. Like as far, did you feel like you connected, I guess, maybe with an audience that you wouldn't have expected?
Sometimes. Well, what I learned is that a lot of bands I ended up liking, not just as people, but I ended up liking their music, giving them a chance just by touring with them. I remember we toured with like Ever Listen to Saves the Day before, and I don't think I ever would have had we not toured with them. But the record that they had out at the time, I can't remember what it was a great fucking record, actually, in retrospect. And their crowds were actually really great. We were weird because I don't think we were hard enough in a genre that it was easy for anyone to kind of say who we were. And so every band that we toured with, there was always some portion of the crowd that liked what we did. Mm. It was never like all or nothing. It was kind of split, you know, usually. So it always kind of worked out in our favor. And we would do those big tours And then we would always do a small tour following it up. And then our shows always got bigger after that, like consistently every time.
So it worked. That wow, that's really cool.
If anything, like Jay said, we said yes to everything because we were just like, we just want to play. Like, let's this. Mm-hmm. We just want to have fun. Like, let's do this. And so probably if anything, we probably said yes to maybe a little bit to our detriment to like, because we were like really pushed ourselves instead of ever. There wasn't a lot of balance in that band.
There you go.
Wasn't a lot of like downtime, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, not a lot. You know, we did a lot, which is cool.
So I don't remember any tour being like awful, like every day leaving stage and being like, I fucking hated that. I don't think that ever happened, really.
No, I think we were maintained excitement about it and the opportunity. I think we were good about that, even though
we also had a mindset of like, kind of fuck whatever anyone thinks. And we just did what we did, which was a big ball of energy, like Phil said, like live. And we just did it 30, 40 minutes. And then we moved on and like, it was hard. I guess it was probably hard to like not at least appreciate that because, you know, so there were only at that time kind of maybe a handful of bands that still had that sort of like underground punk rock energy in like a somewhat mainstream world.
What would you tell a kid, do's and don'ts of being in a band from your experience as a member of Pretty Girls Make Graves? And I'm totally serious about this. Like, you know, like if you could say a do and a don't, maybe, I suppose I just came up with this idea, do's and don'ts, but like what can you tell a kid who's, I don't know, about to do this, wants to do this?
Well, the do would be, and this is kind of like a life do, like everything is like an infinite staircase for me. And in a band, I feel like it's good to have that mindset because if you go too low or too high, it's easy to be disappointed or to just never be satisfied. And I just want, like, for me, it was like always just like, I just want to get better and better and better and better and better and better. And I don't ever think that I'm ever going to get to the top with playing guitar, with doing anything. It's like, just keep challenging yourself forever. And that'll be your motivation. And a don't would be, and Andrea and I kind of talked about this, there are moments in your life, and it may not happen, but where a group of people will come together and something special will happen, and try to be aware of that and like hold on to it, because, you know, we've all done bands afterwards and you see a lot of bands break up for whatever reasons, and like you can never recreate or you can't force a certain chemistry. And so like the chemistry that we had when we were making this record, I don't think we could have, that was one of the reasons we broke up, I think, is we lost two members and just grabbing random people and trying to kind of do the thing again, even though at times it's hard, I don't think we would have had the same outcome. So just, you know, appreciate what you have when you have it.
That's true. I think that's really good advice, Jay.
Well put.
Sometimes I think touring now is probably, I mean, it is, there's not, it's not probably, it's got to be so different from when we were touring. So it's hard to, I don't know how much of it translates, but, yeah, I feel like just do it. Just have fun with it. Like when you're having it, have the most fun. Because there's times I look back and I think about like when I was getting too caught up in other shit where I should have just been having a great time. Like none of it mattered. Like little things that like bothered me at the time did not matter. That goes for life in general, right? So any kid who wants to do it now, I say just do it and just like have a blast with it. Don't sweat the small stuff. That sounds so vague and generic, I guess.
It's true though.
But like
no, it is, that's a very good point. I mean, it's just like in making records, when we made this record, I mean, we thought about a lot of stuff, but we didn't think I don't think we ever talked about how it would be perceived by anybody. Maybe just went, and we just went into it, and there's plenty of times I'm like, I think we should try this, and you're like, sure. And most of the time it worked out. Sometimes it didn't. We changed directions, but it was never like worried about what the label thought or what any of our friends thought or what anybody outside of us six, I guess, there doing it mattered. So going into that as for a young songwriter or artist or whomever they are, they just knowing that if you do it for yourself and you believe in that firstly, the chances of it being exciting and fun and exciting other people are higher. And always remember that aspect of being your own individual shines more than maybe you realize. So that's probably the biggest thing, is just remember who you are in the process and stay true to that, and you'll probably be okay, at least with your psyche. You
know? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's, or I was going to say, I don't know if it's how possible it is to have balance on tour when you're young and fun and crazy, but like if there, that would be advice, if you can try to remember more to take care of yourself also. A little balance in there, probably for
drink some water. Go for a run.
Totally. My God, I was just about to say that and Andrea, thanks for that advice, because I think it's really true. I keep on wondering what would be different had I just exercised for fucking 45 minutes every once in a while.
Seriously.
When I was in my 20s. Yeah. Seriously, because you're just going so crazy, you know, like, and the second I was like fucking 40 when life was so unbearable that like in some movie, I was just like running, just like, you know, like somebody died or whatever.
Really?
And like, and, you know, but then at the end of it, I was like, well, I've never felt this, you know, like half an hour later, I feel different. You know, like, it's like I did all these drugs and drank so much, and I could just to get to feel a little different, and this is better, you know? And like, I think like you said, that kind of balance of getting out of your head and maybe into your body a little bit is like hard to advise, but man, it makes music a lot more fun for a run or something.
For sure. I could have benefited from getting out of my head and being more present.
Right?
Yeah.
You know?
Definitely.
Yeah. So, but there's a thing, and Pretty Girls Make Graves is a good example of the thing about being true to each other in a small environment, like Phil, you're talking about, you know, like an artist on their own being true to themselves and speaking to recognizing when you have a good chemistry. It's really like, I think it's something that everybody really wants, is to be in a gang that can feel good with each other and fuck everybody else. You know what I mean? And then that's obviously a thing that fucking resonates with people. And it's really cool when you guys are a great example where it's like you have your own language, you're totally deciding how this band sounds like this, we sound like this, we agree with each other that this is good. And like that tends to really have resonance. And that's why 20 years later, you could put this record on, it sounds fresh, it sounds good. If somebody told me that this record was a new band, I'd be like, oh, cool. You know what I mean? Like, right. like being, and I think that has a lot to do with respecting each other and only trying to, like, not leaving the room until the thing is good. You know what I mean? Like, we're going to fucking figure this song out.
And that definitely happened. That was the vibe all the time in the control room. There was never a time that any one of us, I don't remember any of us, any arguing. I don't remember any strife. I mean, there was just work, but it wasn't any issues with any members or me or anybody. We just, the whole time, we just always wanted to hit play and be stoked. And I remember feeling that over and over again, and I felt it again when I listened to the record. I was like, oh yeah, that part, oh yeah, I forgot about whatever little things, like I forgot about some of the segues, like Mr. Club, I didn't but I was like, oh, that's cool, like we just did these weird little soundscapey things just because that was fun and somebody had it on their sampler or whatever the hell it was, and but that thing, that it was cool to listen to it back and remember us doing this together and all of us being friends and having a blast and working really hard and feeling it was important because we are in this really cool studio where we got lots of time, which none of us really had much of that. I don't think I spent that long on a record. Maybe I did a Built Spill record, but you know, nothing on an indie style label that long ever up to that point. So it felt really cool to listen to it and go, man, we really did work hard as a unit to make this something special that we wanted to be, you know, that we always felt proud of every time we listened to it every single day. So hats off, everybody.
I think I had one other. Oh yeah, Dr. Sample. I had to get this out because when I read Pat DeWitt's tour diary, he talked about torturing some band member with the Dr. Sample. Does anybody remember the Dr. Sample? Because I had one of these things and I got excited.
I can see it. I can picture it. but I can't remember.
Nick DeWitt's used, best friend.
That's what Nick used.
Nick DeWitt slept with that thing.
Yeah. Nick used to do weird things. Like, didn't he, like, remember, I think he recorded like a cat or dog or something and then would just like make it talk to you or something? Maybe that's what he's talking about. I can't remember, but Nick did a lot of weird things with the Dr. Sample, for sure.
Yeah, the doc. Okay, I just wanted to touch on the Dr. Sample because I'm still just kind of a guitar player, but I feel like that was a really cool piece of tech, and I don't hear it referenced that. I don't hear people talking about it, but it was like kind of a big deal back then because it seemed like a lot of guitar people had it because it was like, oh, I got
super
a sampler
because
I'm stupid.
Yeah, portable.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like. But did you all use a Dr. Sample on the record?
Yeah, Nick, the drummer, I think, didn't he? Like the Mr. Club, I thought he like recorded into it.
Is that a Dr. Sample sample?
We use it on the EP for sure. And then on the Good Health EP. And then he just had it with him. He'd be out. Someone would be doing something and he'd be somewhere else in the studio with his Dr. Sample. Doing whatever he's doing. And then he'd come and he goes, I got something.
Good,
and
okay.
A lot of times we used it. Just like little noises. Yeah. And then Mr. Club was something he definitely made. But, yeah, it was black. It had like push button. They were kind of had lit up red. He always had it with him.
Orange. Yeah. The thing was so cool.
For some reason, I remember a lot of Lean On Me, but done with.
Oh, yeah. See, it was something like that, dude. Like something totally Nick. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
What?
Sounds about right.
Like meow, 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 meow. Amazing. That's so cool. That was really fucking awesome, you guys. Is there any. Did I miss anything? Shout out time.
That's so tricky. I'll shout out Phil because
shout out Phil for sure.
But shout out Jay. But shout out Malcolm and Matt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And Derek and Nick and Nathan.
Nick and Nathan. Yeah. And Derek.
And Derek, I guess the other members of the band, for sure. Shout them out.
The other band members, yeah. Those guys were kind of cool. I mean, I guess they're not here in this podcast, but
they did a pretty good job.
True. Yeah, exactly.
That rules. Thanks so much for taking the time and for making such a cool record and for clearly still being great people. So thanks.
Nice to meet you.
Cool as hell.